order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening. Welcome. Welcome, Rime Sidra. Shamatha Vipassana in the Mahamudra tradition, the moonshine of Mahamudra. Mahamudra moonshine, a special brew. Hey, so tonight we dive into the text itself finally. Starting with page 3. We can start on page 1. Moonbeams of Mahamudra, moonbeams of eloquence clarifying the way to cultivate Mahamudra, the definitive meaning. Mahamudra is the definitive meaning as opposed to the provisional meaning that can be interpreted based on circumstance, situation, student, so forth. Definitive meaning is the ultimate truth, regardless of situation. Patakwa Toshe Namgyal, whose biography we didn't go through together, but hopefully we all read through individually. He's a pretty amazing person. And let's read the introduction, devoted homage to the Guru and the Vajra of mind. The Vajra of mind, that would be Mahamudra mind, I believe. Basically the same as the Guru. Homage to Vajradhara, the Lord pervading all entities and non-entities. How many non-entities can you think of? Make a list of that, huh? His nature is free from elaborations, and he displays all sorts of elaborations as rupakayas. He is free from expression and beyond the sounds of words, and yet his melodic voice of indestructible self-sounds arises. He has purified characteristics related to dualistic appearances of self and other, and nevertheless has the characteristic of compassion, the ground for benefit and happiness. All these contradictory qualities. I'm sure that's not new to anyone here. In the Buddhist tradition, this is a common appearance, these contradictory qualities of ultimate reality. I bow to the unequal teacher, the sole friend for all with fortune, the one endowed with the three secrets, emanating variously throughout the realms. His body demonstrates the play of illusion. From the view of his disciples, his speech proclaims the Dharma of the three honest, each in their own language. So this is the Buddha, the teacher. And one of his famous capabilities was speaking in many languages at once, and everybody heard it in their own language. Sort of like when you go to the United Nations and they have a speaker speak in some very obscure language, and everybody has their little earpiece and translation that does it into their language. And here was this sort of automatic.
So what are the three secrets?
Yeah, what are the three secrets? I mean, if they're secret, can we talk about, can we say?
I think so.
Okay. Anybody venture a guess on one of them? What's one of the big secrets of the Buddha? three secrets of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind that are incomprehensible and have all these contradictory qualities. How can they be that way? How can they appear in innumerable forms and yet have no essence? And how can his speech have no sound, his expression beyond the sound of words, and yet his melodic voice of indestructible self-sounds arises, and so forth. So those are his three secrets, similar to Vajradhara's three secrets, three qualities of body, speech, and mind, and with non-referential vast love. So that's the third type of compassion, which I talked about early on. We went through this page earlier. Equally for everyone, his mind embraces all beings. Receiving even a bit of Chanda's compassion reveals the meaning of hundreds of definitive and provisional treatises. During exposition, debate, or composition, he bestows fearless, unobstructed intelligence. He enables us to realize easily and directly profound suchness, what's hidden for the ordinary. I bow to the supreme deity, exalted Chanda. Please bestow the supreme gift of confidence. Oh, and actually, forgot to look in our glossary for the three secrets. See if I got that right. Right? And also Chanda. Who is this Chanda guy? Glossary of Enumerations.
It isn't Chandrakirti, is it?
No. I thought it might, I looked back into his biography because I thought it might be one of his teachers, but it seemed like, what did I come up with there?
I think it's the guy that features prominently in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, of whom Gampopa is an incarnation.
Right, so it's part of the lineage, basically.
I looked it up and it came up with a female deity.
It might. I mean, it says the supreme deity. I think that's actually who it is.
I got lucky.
Yeah.
So
what
the
else
three
is?
Secrets are not in the enumerations, are they?
No, I can't find them. Yeah.
Something about this female deity, they pay homage to it, relates to children.
Interesting. Okay, so Cynthia has agreed to start a list for the translator that will ask her these questions. So from last week, we had a question on the different qualities of mind, the way that mind was used differently. Right, and that was in her introduction.
Derek, I just Googled it, and you had it right.
Oh, good.
The three mysteries or the three secrets are the symbolic activities of body, speech, and mind.
All right.
So on the first page of the biography of Tashi Namgyal, I don't know if this is the same one, but it does say that in the proclamation of Samaya, blah, 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 Padmasambhava, omniscient one of the three times, declares an emanation of Chandra Prabha Kumara will appear in the actual location. His name will be Tashi and Gyal. So that was one of the possible answers that I had come up with of who is this Chandra.
Yeah, so Chandra Prabha is this bodhisattva that features in the Samadhi Raja, the King of Samadhi Sutra. And then that's also Gampopa and Tashi Namgyal, Tashi Namgyal being a rebirth of Gampopa.
So essentially, yeah, that could be the...
Yeah.
Lori.
And if you go to page 4, the second paragraph, they say that name again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that is who it is.
Cool.
So when they say the three secrets are the symbol, what did they say? Cynthia, were you the one who said that?
Jeff Fuller.
Three secrets. No, Derek had said that it's the body, speech, and mind.
Yeah, but there was Jeff something Fuller. About symbol. And so yeah, I was slow wondering.
Down, slow down, slow down. Jeff Fuller looked it up. He's looking it up again. Just relax a moment.
Okay.
Hang on one second. Okay, so the practice of the three mysteries, the symbolic activities of body, speech, and mind, parentheses, the three mysteries or the three secrets, end close parentheses, are present everywhere in the universe. Natural phenomena such as mountains and oceans and even humans express the truth described in the sutra.
Well, I was wondering about the symbolic activity, if they mean the symbolicaya. So or am I just totally...
To follow up on that, there's something further down. The three secrets, the secret of the body, the potential for actualizing the nirmanakaya, the secret of the speech, the potential for actualizing the symbolicaya, and the secret of the mind. And it doesn't go on, but I'm guessing that's the potential for actualizing the Dharmakaya.
And it's symbolic right. Because there is no speech or body, but there is a speech and a body, and there is a mind, there is none. So it's all symbolic.
Thank you very much. So on page 4, I bow respectfully to Saraha, with a body of space, Nagarjuna, Shawaripa, Tilopa, Naropa, Maitripa, Marpa and Milarepa. So that's the Mahamudra lineage. Having actualized the suchness of the profound and clear intrinsic state, they see all misinterpreted phenomena as false. Misinterpreted. They perfected ground, path, and result with an inseparable expanse awareness. The essence of space. Wow. I bow to the second teacher, famous throughout the three planes, as Gompopa. Who knows what the three planes are? The Great Plains, right? In the Midwest is one of them. And then there's like the Sahara, or maybe the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. Is the one of the plains? No. What are the three plains? Anyone?
The steps would be the
plains. Oh, yeah.
And then the plateau. Tibetan plateau. Very
would
good.
It be the three realms?
The three realms. Yes. What are the three realms?
Desire, form, and formless?
Yes. Desire, form, and formless. Famous throughout the three plains. Says Gompopa. Though previously awakened in the presence of the victor, he took the guise of the victor's son, Chandraprabha Kumara.
Can I ask a question?
For sure, anytime.
Can you, and this is, again, one of those questions that kind of seems pretty basic. Can you relate the three realms to the six, you know, hell realm?
Yeah, so we're familiar with the six realms of beings, which on the bottom starts with the hell realm and then goes to the pretas, the hungry ghosts, and then goes to the animal realms, and then the humans, and then there's the asuras, the jealous gods, and then there's the god realms. And the god realms span from the desire realm, which includes all of the other six realms, are entirely within the desire realm. And then the god realms, there's like 17 levels of god realms, and some of them are in the desire realm. And then there's the four realms of the formless realms that relate to the four absorption states, the first, second, third, and fourth absorption. And then there's the four formless absorptions of space, consciousness, neither perception nor non-perception, and nothing whatsoever. And so there's the gods span all the way up to the top of samsara, the highest peak of samsara. So the god realm spans the three realms, and the term realm is very confusing because it's used for both.
And does the I've seen it referred to that it's a good thing to get. What I always learn is that the God realm, whether it's the Asura realm or the Deva realm, is not a good place to get rebirth.
No, no. The human realm is the best because that's the best combination of suffering and happiness and capability, therefore capability to achieve enlightenment. The God realm, the happiness is too much. It just makes it really hard to achieve enlightenment.
Right, and that they will live long lives. At least the Deva realms will have wonderful life, and then as it comes time for them to die, they get real.
They go down.
Yeah, they go down. Now, I've seen in other places, and I wish I wrote this down, that it's good to get reborn in the God realm. That this person, what happens if someone is meditating in their life and they die? They have a good practice and then they die. And the answer was that they will be reborn in a God realm and from there go to Dewa Chen. There's some God realms that are not like, you know, just have fun and be in a light body and then crash down to a hell realm?
I've not heard that. That opens up a whole realm of possibility, so to speak.
There's something I read this past week, so I'll try to find it.
Usually it's said that the God realms are a trap, and but there are these Buddha realms, so people try to be reborn in Buddha realms, such as Sukhavati or Dewa Chen and Shambhala. Most of the Buddha realms are outside of the three realms, but those two Buddha realms and some others are within the three realms. And so those are achievable by mere mortals like us. Other Buddha realms, you have to be Bodhisattva on the Bhumis.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. The victor. Victor. The Buddha prophesied that as the bhikshu Jivaka, he would appear out of his love for the beings of the snowy land of Tibet and proclaim the definitive and provisional Dharma widely during these degenerate times. In this snowy land, ordinary, they call Tibet the snowy land. Can't argue with that, huh? Ordinary scholar monks and arrogant secret mantra practitioners analyze with their dialectics or practice with their experiences, yet achieve almost nothing. This is the 16th century, right? He's already complaining. I bow with respect to those of the glorious Takpo Kagyu who, having seen the very face of mind's abiding state. What is the face of mind's abiding state? Is it like a smiling face, like a smile face, smiley face?
I think we're just talking about nature of mind, aren't we?
Ah, the face of the nature of mind. Are skilled in revealing it to others effortlessly. Please grant your blessing. This Dharma approach is called Mahamudra, its path which pacifies the machinery of false conventionalities and uproots the various intellectually fabricated experiences. Is the definitive meaning of the sutras and tantras. Others chase the mirages of conventionalities. Some gaze at the physical expressions of their imagination. A few cling to the rainbows of experience. Those are not ways for anyone seeking swift liberation. So a little jibe at other alternative paths that can sometimes lead nowhere. You may have heard many discourses on the definitive and provisional. So definitive and provisional teachings of the Dharma of the Buddha and those who come after him is a common scheme, way of dividing teachings that are ultimate and apply in all situations versus those that are relative to the situation. and reflected upon and analyzed their meaning well, but if you have not meditated upon their true nature, the attainment of liberation is a long way off. So those are the three prajnas: hearing, many discourses, reflecting and analyzing as the contemplating type of prajna, and then meditation prajna, the three prajnas. Some say that nowadays is not a time for meditation. Some such remarks are perverse speech that discourages oneself and others. Fortunate ones who close their ears and banish such ideas will find they can exert themselves in meditation. Containing all the points in the treatises of Sutra and Tantra, the moon of the abiding state appears, and the moonlight of eloquent elucidation radiates here and now. May it delight the minds of those who wander in the darkness of unknowing, those of excellent fortune and discernment who wish to practice meditation on the true nature, who have not turned their backs on achieving a great purpose and are not tangled up in tenet systems of wrong views. Please listen with respect. Once we've entered the door of the precious doctrine of our teacher, the true perfect Buddha, we turn to practicing the genuine Dharma he taught. The most well-known approach is through the 10 Dharma activities. Of those 10, it is said that the primary one and the ultimate object of engagement is meditation upon the true nature. Here I will explain the stages for meditating upon that. Anyone look up the 10 Dharma activities in our table of enumerables? I believe it's something that comes from a sangha. Let's see. 10 Dharma activities: writing, making offerings, being generous, listening to Dharma, memorizing the Dharma, reading the Dharma, explaining the Dharma, reciting the Dharma, contemplating the meaning of the Dharma, and meditating on the meaning of the Dharma. Okay. Nowadays, I observe that most who listen to and reflect on the Dharma do not undertake the approach of practice, and even the few who do practice seem to have a rudimentary understanding of the essential points of the stages of meditation. I will explain meditation upon the true nature out of my sincere wish to benefit those who have confidence in me, since I fear that emphasizing technical terminology and a formal compositional style would make this somewhat harder for the ordinary person to understand. The presentation will be done in a way that is easy to comprehend. Very nice. Thank you very much, Tashi. The explanation of the stages of meditation for cultivating the true nature has two parts: the reasons it's necessary to meditate on the nature of mind, and the explanation of the ways to cultivate samadhi. First, the reasons it is necessary to meditate on the nature of mind, page 6, has three sections. And so this text like has endless repetition of sections. It opens a section and it lists all the parts, and then you come to the parts, and you know. So I'm going to skip some of that repetition. Hope that doesn't throw you off. The reasons it is necessary to meditate on the nature of the mind. The first is that all phenomena are taught to be mind, generally speaking. All phenomena contained within samsara and nirvana, which is pretty much everything. All possible appearances are our own mind. So this is not a philosophical treatise, and this is not a philosophical course. So we won't spend time like debating whether everything is mind or not. That is found in many dissertations on the various tenet systems in the Buddhist tradition, and it's a very complex yet profound point, this idea that everything is mind. And so if you're not familiar with this idea as being a sort of fundamental basic premise for the Mahamudra tradition, then I suggest sort of note it and go with the flow at this point, and sort of mark it internally as something that you might need to return to, because it has a profound impact on the practice, this idea that everything is our mind. And I think you'll see from these quotes that he's not being poetic, nor is it an analogy, as in some situations. And so here he introduces a point, as he'll do this many places in this text, introduces a point and then backs it up with sutra quotations. Starting with the Sutra on the Ten Bhumis, which says, O sons and daughters of the victors, these three realms are simply mind. The Vajrapanjara states, outside of the precious mind, there are no Buddhas or sentient beings. The Samputta proclaims every external internal thing is imagined by mind. Something other than mind does not exist. Pretty clear. The Lord of Hermits, the Shawara Saraha, that's a hard word to say, Shah, the first S with a slash is S-H, Shawara, explains, all phenomena are your own mind. Apart from mind, there's not even an atom of some phenomena. In that case, we may ask, what is it that appears as the things we perceive to be external objects, such as forms and sounds? Mind itself, being itself, unaware of its own abiding state, as it is in many of us, if not most of us, or all of us, has appeared as self another without beginning. By conceptualizing those perceptions, we have amassed latent tendencies and external reference appear to our mistaken perspective. So, latent tendencies to perceive things as if they were not our mind, and external reference are the objects of words and ideas that we have in our mind. So we say chairs or moon or this or that, and we think that those words refer to some independently existing object. So these are external reference appear to our mistaken perspective. The descent into Lanka Sutra states, the mind disturbed by latent tendencies appears as reference. The reference are coming, the attack of the reference. There are no existent reference, just mind. Seeing external reference is mistaken. The Samputta observes, all phenomena are mind's delusion. There are no phenomena that are not mind. What appears phenomena are the deluded mind. So if the mind is not deluded, then what appears is a good question. We'll have to wait till we get there. In the same way that water can create earthen and stone forms when it is whipped up and stirred by wind, external entities, which are solid, hard, and so forth, appear from the full-blown latent tendencies of the deluded mind. The analogy of water turning into various forms is when it freezes, turns into ice, right? For some reason, he didn't say that clearly. Asarha says, when wind hits water and whips it up, even soft water can turn to stone. When whipped up by thoughts, formless confusion can become solid and hard. So from our confusion, we whip up our mind like whipped cream, like making whipped cream at home. Put it in the blender, and next thing you know, it seems like we're surrounded by real things externally. People, computers, reading glasses, all sorts of weird things. Oh, when whipped up by thoughts, formless confusion can become solid and hard. Nevertheless, we may still wonder, how does mind itself become samsara and nirvana? When mind is deluded, it does not know the nature of percepts and perceivers. I think we're all familiar with perceivers. That's like you and I are perceivers. And then percepts is the object of perceivers, in case that's an unfamiliar term. Confused, there is samsara. When that is reversed, there is nirvana. The two-part which is a shorthand way of referring to the Heivadra Tantra, explains, when there is confusion, there are the forms of samsara. When there is no confusion, samsara is pure. Thus, samsara is nirvana. The Samputta says, those crazed and electrified by the overwhelming pervasiveness of the darkness of their many imaginations have minds that the Vajra holder described as samsara, stained by the stains of desire and the like, so difficult to stop. The Vajra holder would be a translation of Vajrapani. Natural luminosity is free from concepts. The supreme, powerful mind, devoid of percepts and perceivers, so non-dual mind, is untainted by the stains of desire and the like. That is said to be sublime nirvana. Nagarjuna observes, what serves as the cause for samsara is it itself once purified, the very purity that is nirvana. That being the case, mind creates the root of all, the roots of all failings and all virtues. They arise from causes that are mental. They arise from mind. The descent into Loka Sutra remarks, forms appearing in the mirror are visible, even though they do not exist. Likewise, when the appearances of mind are not recognized, they arise as dualistic conceptuality. Linked to the latent tendencies of concepts, myriad things arise from the mind. The external appearances manifesting to people are merely the mind of worldly ones. Those non-existent external appearances, the body, possessions, places, and all, are mind arising as various things. I declare all to be simply mind. As the Buddha talking, the Avatamsaka states, another sutra of the Buddha, mind is like a painter. Mind creates the skandhas, all worldly realms, each and every one, are drawn by the mind. The Jewel Cloud Sutra says, mind leads the world. Yet mind doesn't even see itself. Actions, virtuous or unvirtuous, are amassed by mind. Mind circles like a firebrand. So this is a famous image that I think it's Johnny Cash wrote a famous song about, whirling firebrand or something, right? So if you take like a stick that you have burned the end of until it glows like an ember, and you spin it around really quickly, or like you tie an ember to a string or something inflammable. Ring of fire, thank you.
Don't try this at home, by the way. There's also those little plastic things that are glow sticks that they use in concerts. Those are safer than the sticks with fire.
That's great, yeah. So when you spin those very quickly, it looks like there's a ring of fire, but it's just this one point going around very quickly, and that's one of the famous analogies in this tradition for the way mind creates reality out of unreality. Mind undulates like waves. Mind burns like fire in a forest. Mind swells like a great river. The Vajrapanjara states, throughout beginningless existence, external reference have been imagined. All are projections of mind, and all are always mind itself. It also says there's nothing outside of mind. All that appears individually, forms and so forth, are only appearances of this mind. Somebody? Jeff?
Yeah. I think the first session, you, at the beginning of our meditation, you said, I believe you said something like, the heart pumps blood and the brain creates thoughts, or something like that. And it's what it does. That's what the brain does. And my question is this, and it's probably not answerable in a brief way, but the relationship between brain and mind specifically, does the mind create thoughts, or does the mind sort of, are thoughts used by the mind in a confused way when the mind is confused?
Well, you know, it just got easier given that everything is mind. So the brain is mind, the heart is mind, thoughts are mind, rocks are mind, you are mind, everything is mind. So thoughts are a different type of, a certain specific type of activity that occurs in the mind.
But why is, if everything is mind, why is the mind in your head?
I don't know.
Is it?
Anybody?
How do we know that it is? Do you know that it is? Have you?
I don't. Yeah, that's a modern concept.
Hey, chill.
But weren't we saying? Weren't we saying that it's outside of us?
Remember the first question in the first.
Wait. Can we slow down a little bit? It's an exciting topic, but Sue, could you explain your statement, please?
Oh, well, I am referring to the idea that awareness is in your head. And then you connected it and said that the place of the touch is in the mind, not out, but who says that mind is in? That's all. You know, like what's the inside and outside?
So Sue emailed me in the interim about this topic, which is what she's referring to when she said, I said, or you said, she said, you said.
Sorry.
But she's referring to the instruction that I gave in meditation either last week or the week before, where I said, see if you can find where it feels like you're looking through your eyes from. So I tried to word it in a way that did not say your mind is in your head. I said, see if you can feel where it, see if you can determine where it feels like you're looking through your eyes from. And so the eyes are one of our six senses, the other five being the, you know, the four obvious senses, and the last one is the mental activity. And so, like where does hearing happen? Hearing's a great one, right? Because hearing is so simple. Hearing, I think, happens by sound waves entering into our ears. And in the ear, there's a little drum. It's like a big kettle drum, right? And it has little sticks on top of it. And the vibrations hit the drum sticks and they hit the drum, right? I'm kidding about that part, but there are fibers in the ear, and the vibrations move the fibers, which then create neurons to fire that transmit information into a certain part of the brain. And so would you say that the sound waves are sound?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, I think the whole thing is probably the sound, but I think that it is not exactly known where awareness.
You keep jumping to awareness. You like to get very complicated.
Okay, so
awareness is very different than sense perception.
Okay, well, that's what I have to work on.
Yeah, so I was saying, see if you can find out where the sense perception. Yeah, so when we look out of our eyes, mm-hmm. as we all, I don't think there's anybody here that is blind, as we all can do, and we look out and we see whatever is in front of us in our rooms, is there a place that it feels like we're looking from? And where is that? See if you can mm-hmm. determine that. Is it the top of the head? Mm-hmm. Is it the chin? Is it the nose? Anyone? Sue, where does it feel like you look out of your eyes from? Just real simple, not complicated, not awareness.
Well, I actually think it feels like it's here. But I'm sorry. I don't think it's the right answer.
There's no right answer. You know,
I have been looking, and that's, and so, you know, Jeff's question, I was kind of interested in what, you know, I didn't mean to hijack it. So maybe you could go back to Jeff.
the exercise is just to look at your experience, look at your experience and see what your experience is. So there's really no right answer of where it looks like, feels like you're looking from.
I can kind of, you know, you can kind of put it there.
There's somewhat of a process of elimination. You know, it's like we don't feel like we're looking from our feet or our knees or our butt, although some people some people we may think that they're looking from their butt. Or maybe our stomach, you know, when you look at food, does it feel like you're looking at it? But anyway, we're going to come back to that and like go through that a lot. Like, where does it feel like we are?
You know. And likewise, the question, the bigger question that you were asking about where awareness is also part of this practice ultimately.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely get to that also, because that is an excellent and wonderful question that needs to be contemplated.
Yeah, thank you. So back to page 9, part B. The problems of not meditating on the nature of the mind. If we do not meditate upon the true nature, we may engage with the Buddha's teachings, but no matter how much we listen to and reflect upon the words of the genuine Dharma, we will only be able to attain a temporary type of result. We will not be able to achieve final liberation. This has been taught using many analogies, such as those found in the Gandavyuha Sutra. This is a very long one, so I'm going to skip this one. I'm going to skip some of the quotes, if that's okay, because I want to get through this the full section today. So I'll read the first of them, a couple of these verses. The teachings of the true Buddha are not realized by simply listening to them. For example, someone may be helplessly carried away by a river but still die of thirst. To not meditate on the Dharma is like that. Some provide food and drink for many people yet die of hunger themselves. To not meditate on the Dharma is like that. A doctor may be in possession of every kind of medicine but die of an intestinal ailment. To not meditate on the Dharma is like that. In other words, we should meditate. Skipping to the end of that quote, if we do not meditate, we will succumb to our mental afflictions and fall into the negative states. The play of Manjushri Sutra observes, if you do not realize the nature of mind, you will come under the control of your thoughts. Thus you will cycle through the three realms and wander in the six modes. The entrance to the Bodhisattva's way of life, which is the famous text by Shantideva, points out a distracted person's mind is caught between the fangs of the afflictions. It also says those who don't know the secret of mind are a lot of secrets. What is of sublime importance in the Dharma will wander futilely for a long time, despite their desire to attain happiness and destroy suffering. If we do not cultivate meditative concentration, we will not develop prajna. Without prajna, we cannot achieve awakening. The letter to a friend by Nagarjuna says, when there is no meditative concentration, there is no prajna. Therefore, those who abide in ethical conduct, Shila, and engage in listening to and reflecting on the Dharma, in the end must practice meditation. As the treasury of Abhidharma by Vasubandhu confirms, those who abide in ethical conduct, who have listened and reflected, will practice meditation. Thirdly, the virtues of such meditation. The merit of meditating on the true nature is immeasurable. The Sutra Revealing Suchness says, Shariputra, someone who cultivates the samadhi of suchness for just the amount of time it takes to snap their fingers, increases their merit more than someone who listens to the Dharma for even as long as an aeon. So it's the ultimately meritorious activity is to contemplate the nature of the mind, suchness. The same thing, that's a hint, the nature of the mind is suchness. Shariputra, it is for this reason that I strenuously recommend. 10 out of 10 Buddhas recommend this samadhi of suchness to others. The Sutra of the Great Ushnisha. The Ushnisha is that thing that rises up on a Buddha's head when a Buddha achieves enlightenment. The Buddha gets like a big top knot or, one of those things on the top of the head. the merit of meditating on the meaning of dharmata, dharmata, suchness, for one day is greater than that of listening to and reflecting on the Dharma for many aeons. Why? Because that meditation takes you far away from the path of birth and death, the meditation on suchness, dharmata. The sutra of expanding realization observes, resting in a moment of meditative concentration is more meaningful than saving the lives of all the people in the three realms. How about that for a controversial?
Yeah, I really was a little shocked at that. But they're just talking about saving lives, right? Not just...
They're just talking about saving lives.
I mean, it's like...
this is the life of everybody in the three realms.
But anyway, yes, I was a little shocked at that.
That's really sort of bringing home the point, huh? Wow. The cultivation of samadhi. So that's like you're sitting there and you're just about to achieve samadhi, and you have this choice. Should I save everybody in the three realms, or should I enter into samadhi? And they say you should enter into samadhi. It would be better for everybody. Isn't that wild? Cultivation of samadhi is taught to have many excellent qualities. It reverses fixating on the sense pleasures. It cuts through the sources of doubts. It gives rise to supercognitive abilities and samadhis. It arouses great compassion, causes us to see the true nature. It gives us the ability to bring disciples to awakening. The verses that summarize the Prajnaparamita Sutra says, meditative concentration dispenses with inferior sense pleasures and makes awareness, cognitive, supercognitive abilities, and samadhis manifest. The Sutra of the Ten Wheels of Kshitigarbha states, cultivating samadhi severs doubts. Without that realization, nothing else can be effective. Thus, samadhi meditation is supreme. The wise should exert themselves in that. The Compendium of Dharma Sutras comments, by resting the mind evenly, what is true will be seen just as it is. By seeing what is true just as it is, bodhisattvas engage with great compassion for the sake of all sentient beings. The ornament for the Mahayana Sutras adds, through meditative concentration, bodhisattvas establish all beings in the three levels of awakening.
So that seems like that one is the key to that question from the earlier one, because the reason why samadhi is better, it's better than saving lives, is saving lives is just saving lives, but the samadhi enables you to liberate everyone and bring them to enlightenment instead.
Thank you. What were the three levels of awakening?
Oh my. Would that be like from arhat to...
Pratyeka Buddha to Buddha.
Pratyeka to Buddha, yeah.
I think so. It's not in... Well, there's a footnote, 203.
I don't think it said much. I think it just gave the source. I think I looked, but I can look again.
Anyway.
Yes, yeah, it's just the source, Mahayana Sutra Lankara.
Mahayana Sutra Lankara. Okay, part one. Common samadhis. Good place to start for commoner like me, at least. One, shamatha and vipassana, the explanation of the ways to cultivate samadhi. This is two parts. A, the presentation that summarizes the exposition of the common samadhis. This has two sections. One, the summary identification of samadhi and dispelling of doubts. No matter which of the various approaches to practicing the samadhis of the Hinayana and Mahayana is being discussed these days, back in the 16th century, the most well-known divisions and presentations of samadhi are the ones elucidated in sutra-oriented treatises, since what appears in numerous sutras of the Bhagavan, such as Unraveling the Intent, which is a famous sutra that has this amazing chapter on shamatha vipassana as a dialogue between the Buddha and the Bodhisattva Maitreya. The Dharma treatises of Maitreya, there being five of those asangas, five divisions of the Yogacara Bhumi. In particular, the Shravaka Bhumi has the detailed instructions on meditation, and the compendium of Abhidharma by Asanga, Ratnakara Shanti's instructions on Prajnaparamita, which summarizes those texts. So that one is not translated. The five Dharma treatises are translated. Unraveling is, the intent is translated. The Shravaka Bhumi is not, but is in process. There's somebody working on that, thankfully. And Ratnakara Shanti's, the compendium of Abhidharma is translated, and Ratnakara Shanti's text is not yet available, but there's somebody who has a translation of that someday we'll make available. And Kamala Shila Stages of Madhyamaka Meditation Trilogy, which is available, are the most well-known and the most clear explications. But anyway, he's going to summarize all those in a miraculous fashion, so we don't need to search out and read each and every one of those. Although it's tempting, I'll explain the general principles of samadhi according to the teachings found in those texts. A summary of samadhi. It is said in Unraveling the Intent. So this is a sutra by the Buddha. In Sanskrit, the Samdhi Nirmochana. Know that all the many aspects of samadhi which I have presented for Shravakas, Bodhisattvas, and Tathagatas are included within Shamatha and Vipassana. The middle segment of the three-part stages of meditation by Kamala Shila comments, because these two contain all samadhis. Yogins and yoginis should definitely practice shamatha vipassana at all times. Thus it is explained that all the samadhis of the Hinayana Mahayana included within shamatha vipassana, like the way that every part of a tree, its leaves, branches, and the rest is connected to its main trunk. Nevertheless, we may wonder, how is it that shamatha vipassana include all the many different types of Hinayana Mahayana samadhis, those with objects of meditation and those without, the various ones associated with the mantra approach, those with characteristics and those without characteristics, and the numerous samadhis of bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality that are found in the Mahamudra system? Regardless of whether samadhi has an object or not, characteristics or not, when the mind is engaged one-pointedly with a virtuous object of meditation, it is in accord with shamatha. So there you go. There's his working definition of shamatha. When the mind is engaged one-pointedly with a virtuous object of meditation. So that's the culmination, and presumably shamatha would also apply to the cultivation oriented towards that culmination. And interestingly, it's a virtuous object of meditation. All virtuous states of prajna that differentiate the nature of that object are in keeping with vipassana. So vipassana is a state of prajna that differentiates the nature of the object of shamatha. Very different definition of vipassana than probably most of us are familiar with. But this is pretty much the universal way that vipassana is considered in the Mahayana tradition in particular. Let's see. Similarly, in Mahamudra, all states of mind, high or low, that are concentrated undistractedly on their particular object of meditation are in keeping with shamatha. Differentiation and awareness of the nature of that object are in keeping with vipassana. In that way, all forms of samadhi are included within shamatha vipassana. The sutra on cultivating faith in the Mahayana comments, child of good family, this list will inform you that faith in the Mahayana Bodhisattvas and everything that develops from the Mahayana comes from correctly contemplating reality and the Dharma with an undistracted mind. I like that. This list. Gotta have a list.
Hey, Derek. Quick question.
Sure.
When that word differentiate, I'm kind of translating that as an analyzing or kind of.
All virtuous states of prajna that differentiate the nature of the object. Yeah, so, and then later differentiation and awareness. Yeah, so differentiation is the is sort of the basic description of Vipassana. What do you make of differentiation? Analyzing, you say analyzing?
Analyze, or, you know, you discover the nature of that object or something. But that's not one word, that's a lot of words.
Yeah, yeah. What is differentiation? Yeah, so we'll learn as we go through what they mean by differentiation, but it also has a quality of just separating dharmas.
Okay, so you can tell what is,
yeah. What is mind, what is body, what is form, what is feeling, what is perception, what is the sense base, what is the sense object, what is the sense consciousness. Differentiating our experience into its different aspects, yeah.
Okay.
That's a big step in analysis. Maybe not Jungian analysis or Freudian, but Buddhist analysis.
And I'll just quick question also. When we talk about samadhi, are we talking about, one definition is one-pointed meditative concentration or absorption? Is that sort of the specific target that we're using, definition that we're using?
In this context, it's used as the culmination of shamatha or vipassana type meditation. So there's shamatha samadhis, and there's vipassana samadhis, and there's the union of shamatha and vipassana samadhis. So what you described as one-pointed something or other would be more like a shamatha samadhi.
Meditative concentration. So,
yeah.
So it's sort of like fruitional?
Yes. Yes. That's correct.
Thanks.
An undistracted mind is a mind that is one-pointedly concentrated on an object of meditation, correct contemplation of the Dharma. So he's providing a gloss on the quote. Is the discernment and differentiation of reality. So again, we have differentiation and also discernment, discerning. What is that? There's this and there's that. And how do they differ? Therefore, all the excellent qualities of the Hinayana and Mahayana must be achieved by uniting one-pointed concentration on an object of meditation with the prajna that analyzes reality. The final, i.e. third part of the stages of meditation by Kamala Shila begins. The Bhagavan taught immeasurable and limitless types of samadhis for bodhisattvas. Nevertheless, since shamatha and vipassana cover all samadhis, I will explain the path that unites shamatha and vipassana. Secondly, the systematic presentation of shamatha and vipassana has two parts, and we begin with the common exposition of shamatha and vipassana, which has seven sections, beginning with the presentation of the causes of shamatha and vipassana. It's said in the sutra unraveling the intent, Bhagavan, from what causes do shamatha and vipassana arise? So that's Maitreya asking the Buddha that question. The Buddha responds, Maitreya, they develop from the cause of pure ethical conduct. So the foundation of Shila, conduct, and the cause of the pure view that is known through listening and reflecting. So in this case, the Buddha is presenting that we cultivate the view through listening and reflecting, and then we enter into meditation based upon pure ethical conduct. The exalted Gompopa explains the causes that way and teaches that shamatha develops from the guru's blessings, dependent origination, amassing the accumulations of merit and wisdom, and purifying obscurations. What an interesting list of causes for shamatha. Dependent origination, presumably understanding dependent origination. Those also serve as causes for vipassana.
Could it also be just the conditions coming together?
I think they would have said it differently, but it's possible. It's possible, dependent origination. We should add that to our list for Elizabeth. Please. Pretty please. Those also serve as causes for vipassana. The middle stages of meditation list 6 causes of shamatha: to reside in a conducive place, to have few desires, to be content, to reduce activities, have pure ethical conduct, and relinquish thoughts and devolving desire, and so forth. And 3 causes of upasana: to rely upon holy beings, pursue much listening, that is, study and reflect properly. Sounds pretty hopeless, doesn't it? If we have to be content, how can I, oh my God, be content and have few desires? Wow. Relinquish thoughts. It's like the end, it begins with the end. 6 causes of shamatha: reside in a conducive place. The place should have good resources, meaning that food, clothing, and other necessities can be acquired with few difficulties. We're talking concentrated, focused, ongoing, dedicated practice. It should be a safe location, one where dangerous beings such as enemies or predatory animals are not found. It should be in a good area, where one where epidemics do not occur. There should be good companions, meaning friends with similar ethical conduct and views. It should be mentally comfortable, somewhere without too many people during the day and little noise at night. It's very different from Trump Rinpoche's presentation, which is like, just meditate wherever you are. And
otherwise, it would rule all of us out, or most of us out, since we all
None of us have these opportunities. So we would never start. So this is like the ideal situation. And so the Vajrayana approach that has come down to us is like, well, do this internally in your mind, you know. Create a safe space in your mind where you're not endangering yourself, where you don't have any mental diseases, where you keep good company with yourself, and so on and so forth. This is stated in the ornament for the Mahayana Sutras by Maitreya: the place where the wise practice is one with good resources, is a safe location in a good area, has very fast Wi-Fi, has good companions, and has the requisite things for comfortable yoga. Have few desires, do not crave more or better food, clothing, and so forth. Be content. Always feel satisfied with simple food, clothing, and the like. Okay. Reduce activities, refrain from negative activities, including business ventures, excessive socializing with lay people or monastics, as well as practicing medicine or astrology. Have pure ethical conduct, protect the foundations of your training just as they are taught, be they the vows of the Pratimoksha, of bodhisattvas, and so forth. The vows of the Pratimoksha are, those are monks and nuns, of bodhisattvas, and so forth. If you happen to damage a vow due to a lack of conscientiousness, feel remorse and repair it according to the Dharma. Relinquish thoughts involving desire and so forth. Abandon thoughts involving desire by contemplating the deficiencies of all desires, both in this lifetime and the next, and by contemplating that all things in samsara, beautiful or ugly, are impermanent, quickly separated from, and so forth. 3 causes of upasana: rely upon holy beings, rely upon spiritual mentors who have unerring knowledge of the key points of listening, reflection, and meditation, and who have shamatha and vipassana realizations. That's why we're reading this book, by the way, because Thakpa Toshi Namgyal is this kind of dude. Pursue much listening. Listen a lot, okay? You listening? Engender the prajna of listening by hearing the stainless teachings on the definitive meaning. This is not developed through listening to the Dharma of conventional expressions and the provisional meaning. Reflect properly. Contemplate the meaning of what you've heard about, the definitive meaning. This is a big step that I think maybe some of us maybe don't do enough of, is contemplating what we've read, contemplating the Dharma. And by means of inference, generate the unerring view in the form of an abstract idea or general understanding. What an odd thing to say, right? Why would we want an abstract idea of the view? Why? Because that's the best we can expect at this point.
It gets us closer to an actual experience.
Yeah, it gets us closer to the actual direct non-conceptual experience of the nature of reality. So we begin with a conceptual idea. We develop a conceptual idea of the true nature of reality. Generate the unerring view in the form of an abstract idea or general understanding. This is a famous term in the Tibetan tradition, dunchik, a general meaning.
Second,
yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Would that be considered provisional?
Sort of, but it's like it's a conceptual approach to the definitive meaning. So it's sort of like in this tradition, there's two levels of the ultimate truth. There's the ultimate truth that can be enumerated, and the ultimate truth that cannot be enumerated. And the term enumerated is a really odd one, but the idea is that the ultimate truth that can be enumerated is the ultimate truth that can be approximated through conceptual mind. And so that's considered a type of the ultimate in this tradition. In some traditions, that's considered a type of the relative truth. But this tradition indicates how important it is to start that way, by identifying that as part of the ultimate, two types of ultimate. And the innumerable ultimate is the actual real thing, the real McCoy. Elimination of the obscurations of Shamatha Vipassana. This is two parts, beginning with the identification of the obscurations that sit in the unraveling the intent, Bhagavan. Among those five obscurations, which are the obscurations for Shamatha, and which are the obscurations for Vipassana, and which obscure both? Maitreya, agitation and remorse obscure Shamatha. Sluggishness, drowsiness, and doubts obscure Vipassana. Pleasure seeking and malice obscure both. Agitation, the compendium of Abhidharma explains. What is agitation? It is an unpeaceful mind, mental state that is a type of desire that it pursues. In that it pursues attractive characteristics, its activities to disrupt Shamatha. Agitation is any mental activity that goes after what is considered to be attractive. Once something pleasurable and lovely is focused upon, craving for that object projects outwards and disrupts our mental stillness. Remorse, the same text says, a mind that regrets intentional or unintentional activities and things not done, be they virtuous, unvirtuous, or unspecified, timely or untimely, appropriate or inappropriate, is a type of bewilderment. It works to interrupt Shamatha. When our mind repeatedly and continuously regrets activities it has done or not done, appropriately or not, that prevents mental stillness. And so this is an interesting one, because in many places along the path, or in certain places, remorse is a very helpful characteristic that is encouraged for us to experience remorse for negative activities as a starting point for overcoming the propensity for negative activities. The key difference is that when it's used as a helpful step in the path, generally within the context of the activity called confession, which is one of the sevenfold Mahayana offerings, Mahayana activities, the sevenfold offering, prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, and so forth. Confession, it has these four steps to it, and the first is remorse and regret, and then from there it goes to having firm resolve to not repeat it again, undertaking a firm support for not undertaking it again, such as Vajrasattva, and then doing a practice that reinforces the propensity for not performing that again. So in that case, remorse is good when it's followed in that way, when it's dealt with in that way. But if we just dwell repeatedly on remorse without any remedy to it, as I've just described, then it's an obscuration to samadhi. sluggishness. The same text states, what is sluggishness? Being a type of bewilderment, it makes the mind unworkable. Its fruition, its function is to assist all the mental afflictions and the secondary mental afflictions. The explanation of the treasury of Abhidharma says, what is sluggishness? It is physical heaviness and mental heaviness. It is the unworkability of body and the unworkability of mind. Not very helpful for meditation. When there is sluggishness, both body and mind are heavy and useless. Here, stillness and sluggishness are considered to be concordant types, meaning similar. And dullness is not mentioned separately. So the text just has sluggishness. However, in the middle stages of meditation by Kamala Shila, he says, know that whenever your mind cannot see its object clearly, feeling as if it is blind, is immersed in darkness, or your eyes are shut, that is dullness. Therefore, dullness is slightly different from sluggishness, since dullness is when physical or mental lethargy caused the clarity of the object to become lax. Similar, but slightly different. Drowsiness, the same text, the Compendium Abhidharma, states, what is drowsiness? It is the dissolution of mental activities that occurs based on the causes for sleep, be they virtuous, unvirtuous, or unspecified, i.e. neutral, timely or untimely, appropriate or inappropriate, this type of bewilderment. It works to create a basis for activities to elapse. On the basis of the causes for drowsiness, the operative sense consciousnesses, regardless of their objects, withdraw and lose their objects. We all know these experiences well. Doubt, the same text explains, what is doubt? It's to be uncertain about the truth. It's activities to create a basis for not undertaking something virtuous. So again, doubt in some stages of the path is positive. It can lead to understanding the true nature of reality. If we have doubt about our pre-existing view of the nature of reality, if we doubt that sense of self that we have lived with since the moment of our birth, that begins the process of unraveling the belief in the self. But when it's dwelled upon without progressing forward, then it's a problem. Generally, we entertain doubts about the two truths, conventional and the ultimate, and the four truths, suffering and the others. And in this context, having hesitations about what is to be practiced, doubts about what it is or is not, or whether it can be achieved or not, causes us to be reluctant about undertaking practice. So, like confusion about what we should practice and how we should practice, and not entering into practice because we dwell endlessly on that confusion is not, it becomes an obstruction, or what is he calling these, obstacle. Pleasure seeking, this is obscurations. This is a mental activity that comes from craving to maintain, to obtain rather, an object of desire. Malice is a mind that sets out to harm others due to anger or jealousy. Other interruptions to shamatha are the five distractions explained in the Unraveling in the Intense Sutra. Bhagavan, when bodhisattvas are engaged in shamatha vipassana, how many mental distractions do they find? The Bhagavan replied, Maitreya, there are five distractions of attention: external mental distractions, internal distractions, distractions related to characteristics, and distractions related to negative propensities. Those are identified in the same text as follows. Maitreya, bodhisattvas set aside attention to the Mahayana, lower themselves to the attention of the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. That is the distraction of attention. If they let their mind pursue the five external sense pleasures, busyness, characterizations, thoughts, mental afflictions, secondary mental afflictions, or outer objects, that is external mental distraction. If they become afflicted by dullness caused by sluggishness or drowsiness, afflicted by savory meditative absorption, or afflicted by any of the secondary mental afflictions during meditative absorption, that is internal mental distraction. If on the basis of external characteristics, their minds engage with characteristics that are within the domain of internal samadhi, that is the distraction related to characteristics. If on the basis of internal attention, they become conceited because of their accumulation of negative propensities, thinking, that is me, in relation to feelings that have arisen, that is the distraction related to negative propensities. The differentiation of the middle and the extremes by Maitreya states, laziness, forgetting the instructions, dullness and agitation, lack of application, excessive application, are said to be the five faults. laziness, forgetfulness, dullness, agitation, non-exertion, excessive application of the five faults. And we should be familiar with these from the profound treasury. Alternatively, if dullness and agitation are counted separately, there are six. Rinpoche mentions this. Those are taught to be the hindrances for shamatha. Similarly, they are faults for vipassana. Laziness, whether it is laziness that comes from pessimism, idleness, or discouragement, laziness causes the mind to fall into bad habits and lose its exertion for cultivating samadhi. Forgetfulness, this to lapse into not remembering the object of your practice, to become distracted by something else. So he's going through the famous five or six obstacles to meditation. Dullness and agitation, they are as described above. Non-exertion is when the mind does not actively apply itself to abandoning dullness or agitation and leaves them be. Excessive application is when dullness and agitation are passive, and yet the mind does not settle naturally, but keeps applying itself to the object. It's like we keep pushing, even though we don't need to. Secondly, the explanation of the remedies that remove those obscurations has two parts, beginning with the general explanation of the remedies for the obscurations. It may seem that specific remedies for the aforementioned obscurations are not clearly taught. However, since for the most part those obscurations are included with dullness and agitation, the understanding of how to remedy the aforementioned obscurations follows automatically from knowing how to prevent dullness and agitation, the two main problems in meditation, dullness and agitation. Nevertheless, we should be aware of the following key points for agitation. Bring your mind down by meditating on impermanence. So these are the traditional antidotes. When feeling remorseful, do not pay attention to its object. For dullness, rouse your mind. When drowsy, generate a sense of illumination. Doubts are quelled by settling the mind at one point. Pleasure seeking is overcome by reflecting on the problems with the sense pleasures and by feeling content. For a malicious mind, arouse kindness and altruism. Similarly, by applying those principles, we will understand the remedies for the five distractions. The differentiation of middle extremes says eight applications eliminate these five faults. It explains that there are eight applications that eliminate the four aforementioned five faults. The remedies for laziness are four. We're all familiar with, I think, faith, motivation, exertion, and suppleness. The remedy for forgetfulness is the king of mindfulness. The antidote for dullness and agitation is the alertness that recognizes them. The remedy for non-exertion is applied intention. The antidote for excessive application is the equanimity of remaining in the natural state. The first three are easy to understand, so he's not going to explain them further. He's going to start with the fourth remedy for laziness, suppleness. Compendium Abhidharma by Asanga says, what is suppleness and physical and mental flexibility that comes about because the negative propensities of body and mind have been eliminated and its function is to eliminate all obscurations. And the term that's being used here is one that Trungpa Rinpoche translates as synchronizing mind and body. The negative propensities of body and mind prevent the cultivation of physical and mental virtues. The force of suppleness brings physical flexibility, the attainment of physical buoyancy and ease, free from problems such as feeling heaviness in the body. And it brings mental flexibility, the joy and happiness attained once the mind can focus on an object without any trouble. Acharya Stiramati explains physical flexibility is what allows the activities of the body to take place readily and with buoyancy. Mental flexibility is the specific quality of the mental factor that is the cause for creating buoyancy and pleasure in the mind, engaging in correct attention. It is called mental flexibility because when the mind possesses that mental factor, it is able to engage its object unhindered. Suppleness cannot be perfected right from the beginning of our practice of samadhi. However, a modicum can be achieved through effort. So suppleness is perfected when we perfect the ninth stage, after the ninth stage of shamatha. Suppleness is perfected. But we can have a sort of fraction of genuine suppleness occur early on in our practice. When we have refined our abilities through gradual training, we will achieve suppleness. Furthermore, through the force of achieving mental suppleness, the winds that serve as the causes for achieving physical suppleness will circulate in our body. This is a reference to the subtle inner body and the energies that move throughout the subtle inner body called winds. Once they have pervaded our body, we achieve physical suppleness. This is explained in the Shravaka Bhumi by a Sangha, part of his Yogacara Bhumi, is one of the five sections. Mindfulness. The Compendium Abhidharma by Sangha says, what is mindfulness? It is not forgetting a familiar object. Just simple. Not the common definition that's in vogue today. Just simply not forgetting a familiar object. Its function is to be undistracted. When we don't forget an object of meditation that is something with which we are previously familiar, our mind engages it continuously and is not distracted to something else. That is like, for example, if we are afraid of forgetting something we value, we will make sure we don't forget it by repeatedly recollecting it. In the beginning, we must arouse mindfulness repeatedly applying mindfulness, alertness. The sub-commentary on the differentiation of middle and extremes explains, as for alertness, the statement, when mindfulness has become non-forgetfulness, there is recognition of dullness and agitation. Indicates that when mindfulness is fully present, it possesses alertness. So when mindfulness is functioning continuously, strongly, unimpededly, fully, then it's accompanied by alertness, which recognizes when there's dullness and agitation. So alertness recognizes dullness and agitation. Mindfulness is whether you're on the whether your attention is placed on the object or not. Within the sustained stream of the aforementioned mindfulness, which is undistracted familiarity with an object, undistracted not forgetting a familiar object, then alertness examines what is present or not and continuously stands guard at the boundaries of the mind. The entrance to the Bodhisattva's way of life, Bhashanti Deva observes, when mindfulness sits at the mind's door for the sake of guarding it, alertness will naturally appear, will appear automatically. It also says, repeatedly examine the condition of your body and mind. That alone sums up the definition of what it means to protect alertness. This is what we call checking in meditation, checking mind and body, checking your posture, checking whether you're on the object, checking what's happening. Doesn't mean checking your phone. Applied intention. The Compendium of Abhidharma states, what is intention? It is the mental activity that activates the mind. Its function is to cause the mind to engage with what is virtuous, unvirtuous, or unspecified. This is the mental factor that stirs and rouses the mind towards what is virtuous, unvirtuous, or unspecified, neutral. In this context, it is the applied or deliberate attention to abandon dullness or agitation. It rises once alertness recognizes the presence of either one. So you see there's a progression in the experience of these obstacles to meditation and the application of their antidotes. The first step is applying mindfulness. And as we strive to apply mindfulness, our alertness begins to grow, which recognizes whether there's dullness or agitation or not. And when there's dullness or agitation, then alertness will wake up applied attention and say, hey, apply more exertion to your mindfulness. So it sort of circles back to mindfulness. It's the mental activity that activates the mind. It functions to cause the mind to engage with what is virtuous, unvirtuous, or unspecified. So it causes the mind to engage with whatever. And whatever, in the case of practicing shamatha, means mindfulness, is the mental factor that stirs and rouses the mind towards what is virtuous and virtuous unspecified. In this context, the applied deliberate intention to abandon dullness, or agitation. It arises once alertness recognized in the presence of either one. The equanimity of remaining in the natural state, the Shravakabhumi by a sangha says, what is equanimity? It is the evenness of a mind free from any afflictive phenomena when it's focused in shamatha or vipassana. It is characterized by the ability to remain in a natural state, to enter that state automatically, to focus with effortless activities following the development of mental flexibility and by mental ease. So equanimity, once we have coordinated, synchronized, sort of brought to into union or in conjunction all the previous factors, the initial suppleness, the mindfulness, the alertness, the applied attention, otherwise usually translated simply as energy or exertion. When free from dullness and agitation, shamatha and vipassana are balanced, we can settle in those states naturally, having relaxed, strenuous effort. We are skilled in resting and mental flexibility. The same text continues. What are the signs of equanimity? They are that the object of meditation creates equanimity in your mind. And that excessive exertion towards that object is not required. So we don't have to like rouse things anymore. Things become continuously even. It concludes, when is there equanimity? When during shamatha vipassana your mind is free from dullness and agitation. Secondly, the specific explanation of the ways to prevent dullness and agitation has two parts. The elimination of the causes of dullness and agitation. Most of what obscures samadhi is included within the categories of dullness and agitation. The causes of dullness and agitation are said to lie in the various kinds of impure conduct of the three doors. The three doors are door A, door number one, door number body, speech, and mind. The Yogacara Bhumi of Asanga states, what are the signs of dullness? Not restraining your sense faculties, being inattentive of your food consumption, not applying yourself to the practice of not lying down, that is staying awake during the first and last periods of the night. The first and last periods of the night, traditionally the day is divided into 6 4-hour periods, 3 during the night, 3 during the day. And the 3 during the night are, 6 to 10, 10 to 2, and 2 to 6 are the 3 periods of the night. And traditionally the Buddha said that you should not sleep during the first and third, and therefore you should only get 4 hours of sleep in the middle of the night from 10 to 2. Is that okay with everyone? Starting tonight? Good. I'm glad
we're here.
Good. Okay. Remaining without alertness, acting out of stupidity, sleeping too much, being unaware of the methods, being lazy about your motivation, diligence, attention, analysis, being habituated to shamatha. That's a problem. What are the signs of dullness? Being habituated to shamatha. How do you like that? Like being stuck in shamatha. Wow. Bringing to mind a one-dimensional shamatha that is not a completely refined shamatha. Oh, your shamatha is so one-dimensional. Having a foggy mind, not enjoying focusing on an object of meditation. What an interesting.
Well, what does this mean? Being habituated to shamatha and one-dimensional shamatha.
It means. Being habituated to a shamatha that is one-dimensional and is not refined with suppleness, and is a shamatha sort of sinking, a sort of shamatha of dullness. It's not clear. It's not clear. It's not strong. It's not vibrant.
Like a trance, perhaps?
Like a trance. That's right. Yeah. Like you're in a trance state. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like shamatha at all.
It's funny that they call it that. It is. The text continues, what are the signs of agitation? As before, there are four. Not restraining your sense faculties and the others up to remaining without alertness. Acting out of desire. Having an unpeaceful manner. Not being disillusioned with samsara. Being unaware of the methods. Being overly keen about your motivation and the other aforementioned. qualities, being overly keen. That's a wild one, being overly keen, not being habituated to diligence, meditating in a one-dimensional way, again, meaning that your concentration has not been refined, being distracted by any type of phenomena that's conducive to agitation, such as thoughts of relatives.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, your daughter,
yes.
Things like that. The signs of dullness and agitation are the causes of dullness and agitation. Being lazy applies to diligence, intention, and analysis, as well as motivation. Being habituated to shamatha means to be habituated only to the experiences of it, the joy, clarity, and non-thought. Being overly keen means to concentrate too much on pleasurable objects. Motivation and the others refers to the four: motivation, diligence, intention, and analysis. That being so, we should apply ourselves to the ways to eliminate those causes of dullness and agitation. So it's a very refined understanding of shamatha meditation. The ways to prevent dullness and agitation, to stop the coarse dullness. Oh, so there's coarse and subtle dullness and agitation. To stop coarse dullness, just described, once it has arisen, is taught that we should bring to mind things characterized by illumination, such as light, characterized by illumination, the sun, and the excellent qualities of the Buddhas, analyzed with our discerning prajna, increase the scope of our focus, open up our panorama, uplift our mind by rejoicing, and the like. The first part of the stages of meditation by Kamala Shila says, whenever you are overcome by sluggishness or drowsiness, your apprehension of the object of meditation will be unclear and your mind dull. When that happens, cultivate a sense of illumination, of light, taking more light, turn the lights on, turn the brighter light on in the room, open your eyes further, open the shades. And when that happens, cultivate a sense of illumination, bring to mind things that inspire, such as the excellent qualities of the Buddhas. Those will clear away sluggishness and you'll be able to focus firmly on the object of meditation. Sometimes chanting, like lineage chants, are recommended from that point of view of bringing to mind the excellent qualities of the Buddhas. The synopsis of the Paramita states, the force of persevering in Vipassana uplifts and stimulates your mind when it is slack. The heart of the middle way instructs, when your mind is slack, expand it by meditating with a vast focus, with wide open expanse for your gaze. Things characterized by illumination. The Shravakabhumi says, concentrate on the quality of illumination coming from the light of a butter lamp, the light of a bonfire, or the orb of the sun. Now we have light bulbs. We have very strong light bulbs. We should focus our mind on those light rays lighting up and illuminating everything. You look at the light bulbs in your room. Turn on the lights in your room and look at them. As for the actions we should take in the case of dullness, the Shravakabhumi explains that we should bring to mind things with illuminating characteristics, uplift our mind by focusing on what inspires us, such as the sixfold recollection. Uh-oh! Anyone? The sixfold recollection? The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, death, mindfulness, and potato chips, something like that.
Dharma, Sangha.
The three jewels and the three roots.
Our virtues, our generosity, remember the Devas.
I remember the Devas. That's a football team, isn't it? Yeah, the sixfold recollection. Thank you. Generosity. So Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, ethical conduct, generosity, and deities. Law. Oh, let's see, where were we?
middle of first paragraph.
On page 29.
Contemplate the disadvantages.
Thank you. Remember where you are. Contemplate the disadvantages of sluggishness and drowsiness, the cause of dullness, and then abandon those. Move about, stand up, walk around, dance, shake it up, put your left arm in, put your right arm in, shake it all about. Gaze and abandon those. Move about, gaze in all directions and at the moon and stars, splash water on our face and so forth. Coarse agitation is averted by contemplating permanence and being disillusioned with samsara by reflecting on the problems of distractions and rejecting them by resting in shamatha, letting the mind settle into its natural state. The first part of the stages of meditation says, when you observe mental agitation on occasion as you recall previous agitations and amusements, pacify those agitations by bringing to mind things that cause your mind to be disillusioned with samsara, such as impermanence. What else? Death, karma, the failings of samsara. Then apply yourself to engaging the object of meditation without allowing your mind to be overly active. The heart of the middle way states when distracted, see the problems inherent in distraction and draw your mind inward. The synopsis of the Paramita says, when your mind becomes agitated, reverse that with shamatha. It's a little bit of a circular logic here. It was like we're trying to cultivate shamatha and we have the obstacles to shamatha are agitation. And here they say, when you're agitated, trying to do shamatha, you should apply shamatha. As for the actions we should take in the case of agitation, we should restrain our sense faculties, give up strenuous activities as if we were invalids. Just chill. I can't move the furniture today. I can't. Not bring to mind objects that cause agitation. Just don't think of all your problems. Don't think about taxes. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Do many prostrations and so forth. For subtle dullness and agitation, we should use well-known instructions such as, when your mind is dull, rouse it and tighten your concentration. When agitated, settle your mind down and re-rax. I think that's pronounced relax. Relax.
I thought it was a cartoon dog that would say that. Into ours or something.
That's right.
Scooby-Doo. Elmer Fudd.
Elmer Fudd. Comments, suggestions, questions, thoughts, dullness, agitation, subtleness, suppleness. And as you have anybody have like a really good remedy for dullness or agitation? Please. Sleep, yeah.
If yeah, you're really tired, yeah. Sleep.
And then,
I heard that called sleeping meditation before. Anyway, my question was, is it joy and humor a pleasure?
Yeah, those are good for dispelling dullness, right? Tell yourself some good jokes and think about things that bring joy. The three jewels, the six recollections, that's the idea. The three jewels, generosity, Sheila, and deities. God, think of God. Not the same sort of thing. But yeah, think of your favorite color. I don't know, whatever brings joy, right? What else? Any other suggestions for dullness and agitation?
Fresh air always helps.
Fresh air, yeah. Open a window, walk outside. Yeah, so like look to the horizon. Go outside, like, you know, take a break, walk outside and look around. Look at nature.
I also have this little spritzer filled with water that I spray on my face. It works great.
That is so cool. That's great. I was thinking there's a socket right next to me. I could just stick my finger. That's That's great. The spritzer. I love that. I've never heard that one before. That is so cool.
That's good. But like in the middle of the summer, if it's really hot, you take a bandana or something, soak it in water and splash it around on my face and neck and all that
Yes.
stuff.
Yeah, so definitely. Yeah. Or like a bandana, put it on your forehead, like in the, when it's really hot, or the ice cube challenge, right? The ice bucket challenge.
That'll wake you up.
There you go.
I have an old high school friend who's been doing some presentations with us on neural plasticity and chronic pain, and she's into, what do they call it, cold plunge, where it's
yes, like, right. Oh my god.
Oh my gosh, I find it.
Did you do it? Did you do
it? No. But she did it, and it really helped change her mindset. Mm. You know, for some people, it really works. It, you know, she had a lot of problems with chronic pain, and it was one of the many things that she used to help shift. It was kind of astounding. So she does it regularly.
Wow! Just like fill up the bathtub.
She's got a thing in her backyard. She lives down in Texas, and she has this thing in her backyard.
A real one.
A real one. 52 degree. I don't know, some crazy low number. I don't know what it is.
No, it's supposed to be like 34.
I don't know what it is. It's just.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, and you're supposed to go in for like 3 minutes or something.
Does anyone, what are the feelings on things like caffeine, which I am very sensitive to, but it's almost like when I do.
Coffee. Yeah, most people, sluggish coffee. Agitated, have a drink. Oh, no, just kidding.
You're right. Let's not get everyone into habituation to
stimulants.
Material things, whether they're uppers or downers.
Mm, I agree.
Yeah. But you could do like the ice plunge, just have like a glass of ice water and drink it, put your hand in it, things like that.
Put it on externally. It's not so good. You know, cold water isn't that great for your digestion. So
oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, put it on your forehead.
Yeah.
And at the same time, which I feel like I've experienced something like that, but the remedy would be the same, like, as nobody else ever...
What was the remedy you mentioned? I couldn't hear that.
You know, what we're talking about, the cold water or, you know, just to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm using the word agitation. They're using it in a special way, and I'm thinking of some other form of agitation possibly. So.
Cool. Well, let us conclude. We're a little bit over time. Use caution on the cold plunge. It's physiologically bad. We have some good chats here. The cold plunge can be not good for you, bad for many heart.
Definitely heart check with your doctor before you do it. I'm not recommending it. I was just commenting that I do know someone for whom it was helpful, but absolutely not for everyone.
And then it produces Bodhidharma.
It's called brown fat, which is beneficial. But yeah, you do want to be careful if you have some sort of medical issues. You don't want to do that.
You can build up to it, though. It doesn't always have to be the 34 degrees.
That's an extreme thing. I mean, you could always just, like we said, take a little cold water on your face.
I tried cold shower. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I gave up.
You could chant. You know, chanting gets the energy flowing, right? You can do your chants, lineage chant, whatever. Let's close with the dedication of merit. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. Mm-hmm. Oh, that should be attained. Oh, my God. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, made to feed the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east. May the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, everyone. Great to see you.
Thank you, Derek.
Have a nice week.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.